The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon. How are you on this Thursday afternoon? If you want to contact the programme, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Now, sometimes when you're putting together a programme and you're looking for guests, they can't do an interview live. And today, that has happened. So after the show finishes at 4:30, we'll hang around for a while. And then at around 5 o'clock or 5:15, we get to talk to Steve Martin and Martin Short, because they're coming to the Three Arena very shortly in a two-man show. Now, I've told you this story before, so I won't go into detail, but I've interviewed Steve Martin before. And it was an interview without preparation, because it was just thrown upon us, and I thought it was been very clever, and I did word association with him. I asked him to do an Irish jig. Anyway, it all fell flat. It all fell flat, which was very disappointing, because Steve Martin is a hero of mine. When people ask me, what's your favourite movie of all time? I say, The Jerk. Very funny movie. And he's funny in everything he does, and a genius, a comedy acting genius. So anyway, I'm facing in to doing a pre-recorded interview with my hero, Steve Martin, and Martin Short, after the programme today, and I don't want to mess up the second time round. I probably won't bring up the fact that I asked him to do an Irish jig in Las Vegas 15 or 20 years ago. I'd say he'd remember. Hardly. So what I'm saying to you now is, if you want to ask a question of Steve Martin or Martin Short, you know, it's Martin Short, Franck, Steve Martin, The Jerk, Father of the Bride, all of those movies. So if you have a question for them or a comment for them, Martin Short's dad was from Crossmead Glen, County Armagh. Steve Martin plays the fiddle. No, he doesn't. He plays the banjo. Martin Short is into musical theatre, sings a lot, all that sort of thing. Any questions, get them into us throughout the afternoon, and then I can use them in the interview. And then if it goes horribly wrong, I can blame you. I can blame you, yeah. Mr. Tato, as in Tato, have two new flavours out. They do a lot of this over the years. Remember they had the chocolate, the cheese and onion flavoured chocolate. I sort of liked it initially, and then I went off it. But they've two new flavours out. They've beef stew and bacon and cabbage flavour. Obviously just in time for St. Patrick's Day. See, I'm a traditionalist. I'm cheese and onion man. You try them and you go, but you always go back to cheese and onion. I'm faithful to my cheese and onion flavour. I'm monogamist when it comes to my crisps flavours. Anyway, bacon and cabbage, we'll have to get them in, and beef stew flavour are the new flavours, probably from a limited edition, probably over the St. Patrick's Day from Tato. And from Mr. Tato to Mr. Men, because Mr. Men, obviously for St. Patrick's Day as well, has a new book, Mr. Men in Ireland. You know, yeah, Mr. Men, yeah. And it's lovely. He goes to all the places you think he'd go to. He goes to Galway. He goes to the Blarney Stone. He goes up to the Rope Bridge up the north. He goes to the Titanic Centre. And it's all lovely. They're looking for a four-leaf clover to bring them luck. And Mr. Chatterbox is going here, there and everywhere. And then he comes to Dublin. And he ends up in a pub. And there he is. The picture's there. I'm looking at it. He's up at the bar and there's a pint of the black stuff beside him. Now, maybe I'm overthinking this and maybe I should just go along with it. But in a world where we're questioning our relationship with alcohol, is there a place in a children's book for a picture of one of the main characters in a pub alongside a pint of alcohol? I would think the answer is no, but maybe I'm overthinking it. It's there anyway. That evening, they went to a pub for supper. Mr. Chatterbox was in his element, for it was here that he discovered the true Irish gift for the gab. He spent the whole night chatting like he had never chatted before, but when he caught up with the others the next day, something had happened. Something terrible. He had a hangover. No, I'm just put that in. That's not there. He lost his voice. He had lost his voice. I'm a little bit Mr. Sad because of that. And we had Adam in. Adam Hargreaves is the man who does the books now. He's the son to Roger, who created Mr. Men back in the day. And he's a lovely man. And he draws the pictures and he gave us mugs and all that sort of thing. I just probably bad advice on that. Look, there, it's there anyway. Mr. Men and Pint. The Mr. Men from the Irish rugby team are out in Carton House and they're getting ready for the big game. This is the big game. If you don't follow rugby, they're playing England in Twickenham at 3 o'clock on Sunday. England have been beaten by the French. We are unbeaten. We've beaten the Scottish and the Welsh. And say, for example, if the Welsh beat the French on Saturday, then we beat the English on Sunday. Well, it could be a Grand Slam year. And, you know, all the noises are good. The mood music, if you like, is good. Because there's a quiet confidence around the Irish team. And they're coming right at the right time. Now, everyone's making a lot of the fact that the last time we went to Twickenham, we were thrashed, annihilated. But it's a different English team. It's a different Irish team. Anyway, they're out in Carton House and they're getting prepped. And what they do is they bring people in to give them pep talks. And Bono was there yesterday. Bono and Ali went out to say hello to the Irish rugby team. And Bono, there's a picture in the Irish Times, proof of this, that Bono served Johnny Sexton his lunch. He actually applied sauce to his rice. It's a lovely picture there. And there's quotes there. The lads were in awe of Bono. And it looks like Bono was in awe of them. There was sort of a mutual admiration society out there, which is very sweet. And you sometimes get that, don't you? You get that situation where people go, well, you're Bono. And then Bono's going, but you're the Irish rugby team. No, but you're Bono. No, but you represent your country, put on the green jersey and you go out there, you know, and courageous. But you're Bono. No, you're the Irish rugby team. And they're there slapping each other on the back. Get on with it, lads. Get on with it. Anyway, that's nice to see. And we might talk about that match tomorrow again, or maybe not. And if we don't, good luck to them. There are things we take for granted in modern life, and one of them is cutting and copying and pasting. Now, if you work in an office, how many times would you cut, copy and paste in a day? Like, depends on what you're doing, but it could get into hundreds. Anyway, Larry Tesler is the man who invented the cut, copy, paste functions on your computer. He was born in the Bronx, New York, 1945, later studied computer science at Stanford University in California. His prime focus was always human-computer interaction. That's the important thing, isn't it? Putting his skill set to work at the likes of Amazon, Apple, Yahoo and Xerox, he invented the cut, copy and paste, and he has died recently. So we say rest in peace, Larry Tesler, and thank you very much for the cut, copy and paste. And he's been cut and pasted somewhere else, wherever he believes in, wherever he's going. The big paste place in the sky. So that's that. Take On Me by A-ha, which is a classic song from 1985, originally released in 1984. Didn't get much traction, as they say now, but then was re-released, remixed, and it was a hit in 1985. Number one in 36 countries it was. And now it has become one of a few pre-90s music videos to have been watched a billion times on YouTube, which is big news. It joins Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen and Guns N' Roses' November Rain. Because, the people who watch YouTube are younger and they don't know about the 80s stuff and how good and how bad it was, how bad the haircuts were and all that. So that's a historic moment for A-ha. One of the band members says, obviously the video is unique and it has some features that stand up and stand the test of time. It's hand-drawn, which makes it what it is. And then he goes on to say, the song also seems to resonate with people across time. It's just very fortunate to have such a big song in our catalogue. We probably spent a few years talking it down, trying to get people to focus on new stuff we're doing. At this point, certainly speaking for myself, I'm just surprised and proud that the song has done so well and still finds an audience. I'd say that's what happens with songs when you have one big hit. And they had other, Sun Always Shines on TV and maybe one other one. But when you have the big standout hit, there's an odd relationship then, because you don't want to play it all the time, but you have to play it all the time. The fans want to hear it. And what do you do? And I suppose over time, you learn to coalesce with the hit song and you play it and you're proud of it as that member of A-ha is. And we have it here. Take On Me. 51551 RaidRT.ie. Please remind yourself, Ray, that the last time Ireland played England in Twickenham was St Patrick's Day 2018 and we beat them to win the Grand Slam. Well, that was in the Six Nations. Did we not play them last year in the warm-up game? We did. It was a World Cup and they thrashed us. It's the Triple Crown decider on Sunday 1st.
says Dave in Garrison. Don't get ahead of yourself.
Right. I won't. But it's, you know, it's encouraging. It's encouraging, the rugby thing, because we had such a bad Rugby World Cup. And now things are just... Oh, I don't want to say anything. That's me touching a lot of wood. Anyway, 51551, RadioRTE.ie. Good afternoon. Aha! And Take On Me. Come on now. Did more than one or two hits. Hunting High and Low, the epic ballad. I've Been Losing You, Crying in the Rain, The Living Daylights, Manhattan Skyline, all top 10 songs since Lennon Kildare. And Ray Darcy, Wash Your Mouth Out. Aha, had many hits. Don't forget The Living Daylights and Crying in the Rain. I went to see them in October in a sold-out show in the Three Arena, and they opened with Take On Me, and I swear I thought the roof would lift off the place. And you've just made a grown woman very happy listening to the gorgeous, gorgeous Morton, lead singer of Aha. I remember when I was younger having to kiss the TV screen every time they were on Top of the Pops. He was some hunk. I'd say if you ask the majority of people to name more than one Aha song, they'd find it hard. I'm just saying. I think that'd be the case. On music, Codaline will be live in Studio 10 today to sing us a couple of songs. Looking forward to that. And Ray and Alison will be here after 4 o'clock. And Ray is a psychotherapist and Alison is a psychologist, and they regularly come in to offer advice on relationship woes. So if you want any advice from them, free of charge, anonymous, of course, they're very good and they often have different opinions, which gives you a nice balance. Get them into us now, ray@rte.ie. If you want advice from our relationship counsellors, Ray O'Neill and Alison Keating, they'll be here after 4 o'clock.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, 51551 for text. Now, 9 years ago this weekend, Ezra Uiron left her husband and her two-year-old son behind at their home in Clondalkin in Dublin to go to the shops. She never returned. Ezra's car was found later in Bray. Ezra's sister, Berna Fidan, who lives in London, has never given up hope of finding Ezra and regularly travels to Ireland to seek help from the public. And she's with me now in studio today. Thanks for coming in, Berna.
Thank you.
So just Ezra's Uiron, that's the...
Yeah, Uiron.
Uiron, right. Now, you come back to Ireland every year around this time on the anniversary.
Always.
Yeah, and you're always here for Missing Persons Day as well.
Yeah.
You've never... It's 9 years on now.
Unfortunately, yeah.
You were Ezra's older sister. You are Ezra's oldest sister, isn't it? See, you still talk about her in the present, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so tell us a bit about Ezra then.
She's just a beautiful soul. You know, she was a beautiful soul. She loved people. She loved making people happy as well, you know. And it was just a shock to everybody when she just disappeared like that. None of it made any sense at all. And we're just pleading that we know someone's out there that knows something. They just need to come forward and let us know, because it's just getting harder and harder. It doesn't get any easier each year.
How many people are in the family, in your family?
Well, there's myself, my brother, my mum now. Dad had passed away. My two girls and my brother's three children. Yeah.
And this has become your life's work, Berna, has it?
Well, it has. You know, it's taken over all our lives, really. But, you know, we still have to carry on, you know, as best we can. But it's not easy.
I'd imagine you think about Ezra every day.
Every single day.
Yeah.
Not a day goes past without her name being mentioned. People asking me, have I heard anything? You know, there's many people over in London that know me. And, you know, they'll phone me, they'll come in and see me, you know, from my workplace and stuff like that. So, but every day somebody will ask, you know, has there been any news?
Mm.
And unfortunately, I just can't say yes.
Yeah. Well, it's not for want of trying on your part.
Oh, God, no. No. I mean, I've tried everything I can. You know, the first 3 months when she first went missing, I stayed here. I stopped working. I was backwards and forwards. You know, I was literally just coming back home for change of clothes, picking up my own medication and everything, and coming back again, you know, doing all the newspaper, you know, articles, you know, the appeals. As many postering as we possibly could. We had a lot of public support. They'd come out to Bray, you know, to walk the Wicklow Mountains with us and everything.
So let's go back then to how Ezra ended up in Ireland.
Esra got married. She had a job in a pathology lab in a hospital in London when she met her husband. Got married, you know, they were there for about a year and a bit, and he then got a job offer here. So they moved because of the job offer, and they thought it would be a sort of a different start for them, a better life for them. And they came over here because of that, really. And she was here for about 4 years before she went missing.
Right, and she lived out in Clondalkin.
Yep.
And they had a child. What age was Emin?
Emin was 2.5 when Esra went missing. I mean, he was her world. You know, she so wanted a baby. And, you know, you'd speak to Esra and within a couple of seconds she'd start talking about her son and taking out pictures on her phone and, you know, everything would be around him.
And there was still a big connection between the family in London.
Oh, of course, you know, I mean, she would be on the phone to us every other day or we would be phoning her, you know. She'd constantly be on the phone to make sure Mum and Dad was okay and stuff at the time because Dad was still alive. And, and she'd fly over to London every 6 weeks to see us, you know, six to 8 weeks max, you know.
So you were very much in her life.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the time. We was always in contact, you know, even if she couldn't get hold of me, she was on the phone to my daughters. My mum, you know, somebody, her friends in London, she was, you know, she'd come over. We'd always make, you know, we'd try and make arrangements for all her friends and us to meet up and go out to dinner together and stuff like that. So.
And your mum was planning on coming over to Dublin that week?
That week, that same week.
To stay for how long?
A month or so.
Right, okay.
Yeah, a month or so.
And why was that? Why was she coming over?
Well, Esra came over in January 2011. And every time she came over, she'd say to Mum, you know, come over and stay with me for a bit as well. So, you know, she said to Mum, you know, just come over and stay with me. You've got nothing to do here. She goes, you know, spend some time with your grandson as well. And she said, I'm inviting Esra's mum as well, so you can fly out together. But she'll probably sort of stay about 10 days. You can stay longer because I'm at home with
her mother-in-law. She was
yeah. So she invited both the mums over.
Yeah.
And she said to Mum, when you're ready to go back, I'll fly back with you. She booked all the flights, made all the arrangements. Mm. And we kept in touch the whole time, up to the time when she disappeared.
Yeah. So it was a Wednesday morning.
It was Wednesday morning, yeah.
Yeah, and it was this week, if you like, because it was midterm.
Yeah, it was midterm.
And
it
that's sort of half important.
Yeah.
And herself and her husband only had one car.
Yeah. They shared a car.
Right. And what was the deal with the car?
So basically, normally she would take him to work and then, you know, she'd keep the car for the rest of the day just in case she needed to go out with the baby. And then in the evening, she'd go and pick him up again.
Right.
That's how it was. And occasionally, if he said, you know, I'm going to go to the gym, so I'll take the car for the day. And that was nothing unusual either. You know, he would take the car occasionally.
So on this particular day then?
That's what happened.
What happened?
He'd said that, oh, I'm going to use the car today so I can go to the gym on the way home. And my sister said to him, well, if you're going to take the car while you're getting ready for work, keep an eye on Emin. Let me just nip out, buy a few bits I need. And then when I come back, you can take the car and I don't need to go out again.
All right.
And that was it.
And that was the last conversation she had with her husband.
Yeah. And then she was never seen again.
Right. And how far was it from the house to the shops?
2-3 minutes.
Yeah.
2-3 minutes, that's all.
So he was expecting her back within 20
minutes. Well, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, he said that she left the house 7:15, the latest, because he needed the car back to go to work.
So he was watching the clock.
Yeah,
yeah,
of course. And so it was just unusual because, I mean, I spoke to her on the Sunday prior to her going missing. So she went missing on a Wednesday. I spoke to her on the Sunday and she said to me then, she goes, oh, I forgot a few bits to get while I was in London. Gave me a shopping list of spices and stuff she wanted me to send with Mum. On the Monday, she phoned one of her friends because it was her friend's son's birthday to wish him happy birthday. On Tuesday, her neighbour saw her, you know, taking out rubbish and she said to her, what's this spring cleaning in February? And she said, well, the mums are coming over. I'm getting house ready. When I spoke to her on the Sunday, she goes, oh, I'm going to surprise the mums because I'm booking a spa and a posh restaurant because it's going to be my birthday while they're here. Because her birthday's on the 1st of March.
Right.
So it'll be yet another birthday.
She was 37, going to be 38.
Yeah.
She was a striking looking woman.
Definitely.
Yeah. I've seen pictures, green eyes.
Yeah.
You have Turkish heritage, so sallow skin,
yeah.
Dark hair.
And had she got her hair dyed blonde at that stage? No.
So, yeah, she had highlighted hair.
Highlighted her hair, right, okay.
Yeah. I mean, she used to wear her hair very dark as well, so people know her with dark hair and light hair. So
when did you realise there was something wrong?
Her husband phoned us in the evening. He didn't want to alarm us and worry us, he said. But he'd already phoned the Garda. The Garda had told him, you have to wait 48 hours for a missing person. And, you know, by the evening, when there was still no sign of her, like he said, he'd phoned her phone several times. It was just constantly going on to message. And then he said, like, then he obviously called us because there was just no sign of her. And I said to him, I don't care what the Garda are saying. You need to take a picture of her, go there, and at least let them find the car. Because if she's driven with the car is somewhere. It's got to be picked up. And then it was 11 o'clock that same Wednesday night that he phoned back to say they found the car in Bray.
Right.
They did do an initial helicopter search. By next morning, I was there anyway. I made the arrangement straight away and just came straight over.
What was that flight like for you?
It was a nightmare because I didn't know what to expect. I thought I was just going to find her, put her on the plane and bring her back. That was my... I actually bought a return ticket thinking, okay, by Monday I'm taking her back. But then obviously that didn't happen.
So the car was found out in a car park in Bray.
Yeah.
And the last message, the last signal they got from Ezra's phone was on
around
Bray Head.
Yeah. Okay. But then it's a mobile. Anyone could have that mobile.
Yeah.
That doesn't prove that she was there. Not to me anyway.
Mm.
You know, it's a mobile phone. It gets carried. So it could be anywhere.
What happens then? You know, because you were all over. You stayed here, as you said, for 3 months after Ezra disappeared. So you were constantly in conversations with An Garda Síochána Síochána.
Yeah.
Did they immediately start looking at CCTV footage or what happens?
Well, they obviously had to wait for CCTV footage to come down and stuff like that. So, you know, everything took what seemed like forever to us because I'm running around, you know, we're running around trying to think, you know, where could she be? Where, you know, it was constantly in Bray because that's where the car was found, you know, walking the mountain. I mean, I've walked from, you know, Bray's Head to Greystones. So many times, backwards and forwards, and across other parts of Bray's Head and stuff like
hoping
that. Just hoping that I would come across something of hers.
Yes.
Eventually, when they came back and did, you know, because when I got there on the Thursday morning, her car was still in Bray, and it was Thursday late afternoon that the Garda took the car away. And then it was quite a few days after that that they came back to say, you know, due to from forensics, it was only her and her husband's fingerprints in the car, but her purse was actually in the boot of the car. Now, we're talking about a purse no bigger than a phone. And I said, why would she put her purse in the boot? We're not talking about a handbag.
That's interesting, yeah.
And I've said, did something happen to her that, you know, if I was going to go for a walk or anything, I'm not going to put my purse in the boot. I'm going to put it in the glove compartment or under my seat or something. I'm not going to physically get out of the car to throw it in the boot because it's just a little purse.
So you've thought about that a lot in the last...
I have thought. I mean, it's done my brain in thinking
years.
About
so,
it,
yeah,
you know, because
so,
I, you know, I've gone, think outside the box. Was she in the boot of that car?
Her purse fell out of her pocket or...
Yeah, you know. I know they haven't said, you know, they found any forensics of anyone else's prints, but then, you know, gloves, whatever you... Not necessarily leaving any prints, are you?
Yeah.
So
you, when you got there then and the car was there, did you immediately start doing your own work, investigating?
Well, yeah,
work?
I mean, we were walking around up and down Bray, stopping people to say, you know...
In the days and weeks after...
Well, yes, I mean, I literally was making sure I was getting to Bray 8 a.m. in the morning, sitting on the wall where her car was parked, just to see who was actually walking past at this time every single morning. And it was mainly the same sort of people, walking their dogs, taking a jog, whatever.
People have routines.
They have routines and they would stop and talk to me, you know, because they realised, you know, I was sitting there with a poster in my hand, handing it out to everybody, going around everywhere. And, you know, they'd stop and talk, and they said, you know, and everyone didn't see her.
Mm.
Because if we had, she'd be a different face to us. Like we're stopping off and saying, are you okay? We would have said exactly the same to her.
Yeah.
You know, so nobody remembers seeing her there.
And what time did the car hit Bray at?
The car hit Bray around 20 past eight-ish.
Okay.
That sort of time.
After leaving Clondalkin at...
About 20 past seven. And right. It shouldn't take an hour anyway. It doesn't take an
even
hour.
Even with traffic?
Even with traffic. I mean, it's half-term week. There's not going to be that much traffic anyway.
Yeah.
But we've done that trip so many times. In traffic and out of traffic, because we're here at the same time every year. And we've literally started that journey at 20 past seven in the morning. See, her number plate was first read at the power station roundabout, which is only a 4-minute drive from her home.
Power
City roundabout.
Oh, Power City roundabout,
sorry.
Yes. Power in Clondalkin.
City, yeah, in Clondalkin. So that's only like a 4-minute drive from her house.
Yes.
You know, okay, 5-6 at a push. But then their cameras showed that it was just before 8 o'clock. Now, that's half an hour.
Could her husband have got the time wrong?
Oh, if he's going to work, how could he have done?
I know, but what I'm saying is...
You know, I mean, but even so...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so it's not 20 past seven, it's half past seven, but it's still going to not take you till 8 o'clock to get to that spot.
Okay, right.
It's just still a 4 or 5 minute journey.
So in your mind then, that's an oddity. There's something...
Well, yeah, because, there. I mean, I've always said, you know, was she flagged down? Did she stop for something? You know.
What are your theories?
Did something happen there?
And what are your theories?
Oh, do you know what? My mind's a sieve at the moment because I don't know what to think anymore.
Yeah.
I truly don't know what to think.
You've probably
anymore.
Gone through every permutation of what
might
happen.
You go through so many scenarios in your head that I just, you become numb to it sometimes.
Yeah.
But I just don't know what to think anymore. But I know someone must have seen, someone must have heard, someone's out there and they know, you know, no one's going to disappear off the face of the earth and no one's seen or heard. We're just begging that person to come forward, you know.
So there's that. It took longer than it should have to get to the Power City roundabout from the house.
And then from the Power City to Bray, yes, it was the right
time. It was the right time.
Time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if, for example, somebody got into the car with her or whatever, although there's no fingerprints, and then decided to drive her to Bray, that seems that could have happened. Had she ever been to Bray before?
Several times.
She had?
Yeah. So she knew the Bray area because it was one of the closer places, you know, to go and get some fresh air and stuff like that. So, you know, they'd take the baby down there and whatever. Yeah. So they used to go to Bray.
Right.
Or if, you know, one of her friends came to visit her from London and then she took them down to Bray for the day as well.
And would they do that walk, the Bray Head to Greystones Walk? Or?
No, not all the way.
No.
It's literally just up to the, you know,
yes.
the little walk up to the top to have a look at the scenery and then come back down again, you know, but it wouldn't be all the way.
So the CCTV caught the Twingo, is it?
Renault Twingo.
It caught that on the road and then went into a car park behind the amusements, and then came out again, went into another car park.
It went into the same car park.
But there was no CCTV on the second time.
No.
Why was that?
Because when the car first came down the Strand, it went straight into the car park within less than 30 seconds, left, went back into the one-way system. Then it came out of Convent Avenue where it had a near collision with a Skoda Octavia.
Yeah.
And we begged and begged for that driver to come forward, you know, because if someone's nearly hit you or cut you up, you're going to turn and have a look.
Mm.
And all we wanted to know is, you know,
who was driving
that car? Was she driving? Was there one person? Was there two people?
But the CCTV wasn't clear enough to tell you definitively that Ezra was driving that car.
No.
And you think that it could be somebody else?
It could be.
It could be.
There's always a possibility. Okay. It could be anybody.
Now,
because the driving was so erratic,
yes,
it's not even her type of driving.
Now, you know they have new technology now to enhance CCTV footage. Has that come up in your conversations with Angardi?
For years.
Right.
For years. They had it, well, they tried to have it enhanced here. It didn't work. Eventually, years and years later, a few years ago, they managed to get it to London and they said they couldn't do anything there as well.
So... parked, there's no CCTV of anybody getting out of the car, but then there is a bit of CCTV of a woman walking up towards Bray Head.
See, that's so unrealistic, for the sheer fact is I've seen an image of that CCTV from the Star Amusement Centre. They allowed me to watch it when her car came in, went out and came back in. That car park was virtually empty at that time of the morning. Now, the Gardaí cameras that watched the Strand is on a swing motion. At 8:30 when her car got to Bray, it was watching the Strand. When it swung round to where they showed me a footage of that woman, that car park was chock-a-block full and it was about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, right, OK.
It was hours later. So that's not realistic.
Did
and that
have,
woman...
Did they not have a time code on it, no?
I don't know.
No, OK.
But that car park was so full with loads of people around and everything.
But you're confident that that woman wasn't Ezra?
No, that wasn't Ezra. I mean, that was a woman waiting for her dog. They said, oh, it's a woman standing there aimlessly. But if you keep watching the footage, she's actually waiting for a dog. As soon as the dog comes and walks past her, she turns and walks behind the dog.
Now, and you know well, but when somebody disappears in circumstances like this, suicide is always mentioned.
Of course.
Yeah.
Give me a body. That's what I say.
Right.
She didn't bury herself. Even if she'd gone into that sea, it would have washed her up somewhere. We had sea searches over and over again. First week, second week. Well, the first week a few times. We had the Bowen fishermen come out. We had the Limerick crew come out months later as well, because they said, you know, it could be washed back months later. So it went over and over again. Mm. You know, it wasn't just searched once. The mountain areas were searched. You know, we had the volunteer groups come out with us. They did paragliding over and then they sort of, you know, letting themselves off the sides of the cliffs to see if they could.
And you've spoken to people who would have an expertise in how dead bodies behave, I'd imagine.
Yeah,
and they would always be washed up, would they?
Somewhere.
Somewhere.
Yeah, of course.
Here, Wales.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, but we haven't had anything.
9 years on.
9 years on.
Yeah.
And it's...
And was there any... Because you've gone through all of this. I'm sorry to go through it again, but just for our listeners. And this is why I was talking to you about the phone calls and your mum and mother-in-law coming over. Was there anything that would suggest that Ezra was in a bad place?
No. Because she was making plans. Mm. You know, if they tried to say to me, oh... You know, your dad passed away. Maybe that triggered her off. And I said, yeah,
When did your dad pass away?
October.
Okay, and this was February.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I said, okay, dad passed away, but dad was ill for 20 years. And for the last 2 years of his life, he was bedridden on morphine and didn't even know what today was. We was at a stage where we were praying that he would go peacefully and not suffer anymore. So his death wasn't a shock to us.
Right.
Yes, it was sad. Of course it was sad we lost our dad. But, you know, it was a relief also that he wasn't suffering.
Mm.
You know, Esther came over. You know, she managed to see him before he passed away. She stayed for the funeral. She came back again several times after that. You know, there was nothing to say that she had any issues with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course she missed us. She missed, you know, she missed everybody. It wasn't.
And you were close with Ezra.
Of course.
She would have confided in you, I would imagine.
Yeah. But even her closest friends, they was in total shock. Like, but she tells us everything. How can she go without talking to us? And that's why I say, you know, no one can believe that she's just gone off her own will.
I tell you what, we'll get you a glass of water and we'll just give you a couple of minutes. We'll take a commercial break and we'll continue after that.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we're speaking to Berna, whose sister Ezra disappeared 9 years ago this weekend in Bray. Well, that's what they say. It could have been somewhere else, you think, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. And how is your mum?
She's not very well. She hasn't been very well for years. And as years go on, her health deteriorates some more. But she's holding on. She's holding on as best as she can. I mean,
and whenever I saw that, when people say to you, could it have been suicide? Yeah, like, and I'm sure I saw a documentary where the detective in charge sat you down and suggested.
Did I want to hit that detective?
suggested, but you can see why people would.
Yeah.
Can't you, Berna?
I can see, but there needs to be a reason.
Mm.
You know, you're not going to make plans, bring your mother over, bring, you know, invite your mother-in-law and then decide, oh, I'm going to commit suicide. Mm. See, my sister, if that was her intention at all, the month before when she came over with her husband and the baby, she had a meeting to attend. So she came back 3 days earlier than her husband and the baby. So she had 3 whole days to do what she wanted, if that was her intention.
Did she actually need stuff in the shop?
Well, I wouldn't know.
No, I know. Yeah. I know. That's the question, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I said to her husband at the time, like, what was she going out for? He goes, well, I'm not sure. He goes, you know, she said, she's going to pick up some milk and stuff. And he goes, maybe she wanted to buy a packet of cigarettes. And he goes, because I don't really like her smoking. Uh-huh. And she didn't want me to go out and buy it.
Right.
But
yeah,
I don't know.
And I've spoken to families of missing persons before, and some families don't like to in any way imagine what might have happened. Where are you on that?
I don't want to imagine that she's suffering.
Okay. Do you think she's still alive?
I think I'm getting to a stage where I don't know.
Mm.
I don't know. You know, you hope that she's still alive. There's that hope she's still alive. But I wouldn't want her to have suffered all this time.
Mm.
I think that's another thing that eats at me, that if she's being kept somewhere and she's suffering.
So that's one of the theories you've entertained over the years, that
you think of this, don't you? I mean, is it a possibility? You hear of all these cases where women have been locked in cellars and rooms and whatnots, you know. So of course, you know, that's also played on our minds. But I'd hate to think that that's what she's going through.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think maybe she has, you know, she's dead somewhere and she's been buried somewhere, but we have no proof of any of this.
Mm.
So we have no closure, which makes it even harder.
Yeah, it's a big open sore. You know,
there's some families who know that their loved one has passed and they can't find the body. But we don't even know if she's dead or alive.
Mm.
Which, you know, I mean, it's bad for all of us, but I don't know which is worse.
Mm. And you've been over, as we said, for Missing Persons Day and this time every year for the last 9 years. Have you had any leads in that time? None.
I've, you know, not a lot of stones unturned. I mean, we've tried to follow up on anything anyone said to us, you know. I mean, we've even gone down the, like, where mediums have said, you know, it could be in this area.
Oh, mediums, you've gone to mediums, yeah.
Or they've approached us as well. But I'm not sweeping them under the carpet because, you know, you're thinking, okay, there could be some truth in it. So I've gone into the area, put posters up and hoping that someone will come forward because I'm thinking, well, any information, because you're grabbing to see, you know, any little bit of string that you can grab and pull to see if I can get some information from anybody. But nobody's coming up with any solid information at all that could lead us in the right direction.
This is probably the most painful thing to think. Like, if Ezra took her own life, there may be no witnesses. And there still is no body, and I can't explain that, but there, you know, she would have waited till there was nobody around and then...
Yeah, but where is the body?
Yeah, where is the body, yeah.
So that's why I can't take suicide seriously on this.
Yeah.
I can't accept that it's suicide.
You have to mind yourself as well.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And have you thought about a time when, and that you won't come over to Ireland every year?
If I physically am in a bed, okay, that I can't move.
Oh, only if you can't.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't intend to stop coming over because she's my little baby sister, my only sister.
Yeah.
You can't give up, can you?
No, I can't imagine what it's like. I actually can't imagine.
Because we're a small family anyway, you know. And I haven't I don't know. I mean, my mum's not well. My brother's had a heart attack. And it's just, it's taken its toll on all of us.
Yeah. What do other people do, Verna? And I know it's different for everybody, but, you know, like, is there counselling? And I know there must be...
Oh, do you know what? They suggested I went to counselling just to sort of help me, you know, deal with it. I think it just put me in a worse mood because all I did was sit there and cry, and I said, I feel worse coming out of this than it. Okay. So it's not something that suited me. I don't think it suits everybody. Okay. But...
Maybe somebody's listening today because you haven't done national radio before. You've been in a few reports, but we haven't sat down and had this chat.
Yeah, we've done sort of things like
East Coast
crime,
radio
and crime call and things like that. And, but, you know, you obviously have different listeners to, you know, because not everybody reads the same paper, not everybody listens to the same radio station. So I'm hoping today that I'm reaching people that have never heard this story before.
So it was the 23rd of February 2011, it was midterm, Wednesday morning. So a big question mark for you is that between Clondalkin and the Power City roundabout, did something happen there? And then when she got to the car park in Bray, where did she go from there? Did anybody see her? That Octavia, Skoda Octavia, that there was a near miss there.
Is
that person, do they know that they're that person and just has been reluctant to come forward, and maybe now is the time they'll come forward and they might...
Oh, please do. You know, we just need someone to come forward. You know, we're begging for someone to come forward. Then somebody must know.
Yeah. Okay. Mind yourself.
Thank you.
It's torturous what you're going through, and I hope you get some resolution and, as you say, some closure at some time in the near future.
God willing.
Yeah. Verna, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551 Ray at RTE.ie. And just a reminder that Ray and Alison are along after 4 o'clock to give you any advice you might need on your relationships. Ray at RTE.ie if you want any advice from Ray and Alison. After 4 o'clock. Now, Coda Line, join me in studio. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
How's it going?
How are you, Ray?
It's an exciting time for you.
It is.
So you've just announced that you're doing 3 intimate gigs in the Olympia Theatre. Yeah. Now, when does a concert become intimate?
It's a good question.
Yeah. What's the... Is it when they put a roof? Is that it? Because the last gigs you did were in...
St. Anne's Park.
Yeah.
And before that was... Marley Park and Malahide Castle and stuff. So yeah.
So you're doing them in the Olympia Theatre.
Yeah. There's a roof this time. Doesn't matter if it rains.
And why do you want to do?
I think our first kind of gigs that we kind of felt like we were doing something right was in the Olympia. We did 3 nights there in 2013, and it's also like we've been lucky enough to play kind of everywhere, and it's still one of the most beautiful venues to play in. And also when you go to a gig there, there's kind of a feeling about it. So. Yeah.
We've been quite lucky to play like kind of small rooms across the world, and there's something very different about doing the big outdoor one to playing to like 1,500 people in a room. You know, there's a better connection. So I think you do a few of those and you...
I think I have a feeling they'll know all the words.
Hopefully.
We will.
That's guaranteed.
Well, hopefully Steve remembers the words.
Yeah, exactly. Wouldn't be the first time forgetting words.
All right, what are you going to sing for us? Not the new single. We leave that till about 4:20. You're going to do a cover of Maroon 5's Memories.
Yes.
Yeah. When you're ready, Coda Line. No worries.
Here's to the ones that we got. Cheers to the wish you were here, but you're not, cause the drinks bring back all the memories of everything we've been through. Toast to the ones here today. Toast to the ones that we lost on the way. And the drinks bring back all the memories. And the memories bring back you. There's a time that I remember when I did not know the pain, nothing lasts forever, and everything must change. Now my heart feels like December when somebody say your name, reaching out to call you, just to talk to you again, singing. Everybody hurts sometimes, everybody hurts some days, everything will be alright, so raise a glass and say, hey.
Here's to the ones that we got. Cheers to the wish you were here, but you're not, cause the drinks bring back all the memories of everything we've been through. Toast to the ones here today. Toast to the ones that we lost on the way, cause the drinks bring back all the memories, and the memories bring back memories, bring back you. La da 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 da. La da 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 da. Ooh, la da 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 da. La da 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 da. And the memories bring back memories, bring back you.
That was great. That was lovely. Mark, Steve, Jay and Vinny, Codaline. And those gigs, the tickets are going on sale tomorrow. They're on Wednesday 27th of May, Thursday 28th and Monday the 1st of June in the Olympia Theatre. Intimate gigs. And the lads are going to stay on to perform their new single, Wherever You Are, after 4 o'clock. For the moment, Codaline, thank you very much. Thank you. 51551 ray@rte.ie. And Codaline will be back to sing us out at the end of the programme. But right now, I'm joined by Ray O'Neill and Alison Keating. Good afternoon to you too.
Good afternoon.
Alison and Ray drop in every so often, once a month or so, to offer advice on relationship woes. Now, we've a good bit of time and a good bit to get through. So let's start with this one. Dear Alison Ray, I don't enjoy spending time with my oldest friend anymore because I just don't approve of the way her adult children conduct their lives. Despite being perfectly healthy, her two sons don't work and sponge off her, but my friend constantly makes excuses for them. My children are the same age and work really hard, and just hearing about her kids makes my blood boil. I really feel like I should tell her how I feel, but I'm afraid it might be the end of our friendship. That's a tough one. Ray, I'll go to you first.
Oh, cheers. this, like, again, I suppose my question would be, what has this really got to do with you? Like, if your friend is your friend, why should her mothering or her children get in the way? Because if whatever's going on in this scenario, I just feel this is really unnecessary level of anger.
Well, I would think that a lot of their conversations revolve around their children.
Mm. Okay.
And as a result, every time they meet, this woman is reminded of how the behaviour of her friend's children doesn't fit with her view of the world. And her kids are, you know, out there working hard, doing what they should be doing. And that annoys her every time. And now she's focused in on it and it's just getting more and more irritated.
I think it's focused in on it. I think sometimes that can happen where you're with somebody and they're really caught in a loop with the same conversation. And, you know, professionally and personally, when the same people come with the same thing and the same conversation, meeting after meeting after meeting, it does get exhausting. Mm. I mean, when you're paid to do it, you can manage it a little bit better. But when you're trying to have a Friday night at the pub, you're like, get over yourself already. I think then it's literally to just say this, like, can we just have an evening not talking about the kids?
Right.
And just remind yourself why you liked this person and why she was your friend.
Now, Alison, if she says that to her, she's going to say, why do you not want me to talk about my children?
Absolutely. Yeah. I suppose the first question I'd have is, everybody has different ways to parent, and you either accept or you don't accept. And what we have to look at is what's underneath it. It's their value system, and it's really interesting. You know, people can get and feel extremely strongly when they feel someone's parenting wrong, which is not the way they do it. And the decision here is basically: do you like your friend or not? Can you accept or not, you know, what's going on for her, you know, if she's letting her children, you know, like she's saying that she's making excuses for them, but it's impossible to kind of get to the crux of it. But as Ray is saying, it's bringing up such a strong reaction that I would say, you know, I'm not sure you can actually stay friends.
Mm.
You know, because what conversation? I'm not like that. That's a very difficult conversation. As you said, if you go to dinner and say, hey, let's not talk about the kids. I hate the way you parent. It's going to be a short dinner. It really, really is. They're only going to be defensive because they feel attacked. I just don't know how there's a way around this.
Yes.
She either, I'd say, accepts the friend and the way her friend parents, or she doesn't, and that's her decision. But to continue in a kind of a negative way, to feel like blood boiling is strong words. Yeah. So, you know, make a decision.
An interesting word there is I don't enjoy.
No, that's what I got.
Spending time with my oldest friend anymore.
I mean, friendships change.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm hearing here as well, is that maybe they felt on the same parenting page. Now she doesn't feel they are. So I think it could be like that their values are misaligned at the moment. And it's not nice to have kind of that strong feeling within a friendship. It's not very healthy. So I'd question, do you really want to be friends with this person anymore? Is it really about the sons?
Yeah. Right. That's another. That's interesting. Mm. Is it something else? Is this just...
Is there something else?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A symptom of something deeper. That's interesting. So you have to ask yourself all those questions. I don't know if it's going to work out. I think I'm with you, Alison. I don't think this is going to work out.
I think like that point that like friendships evolve, and sometimes, you know, we create expectations about relationships, friendships or intimate, and we haven't communicated that to the other person. Mm. So the friend could just think they're just having a chat about their kids.
Absolutely.
And she's like, but I don't want to talk about these kids anymore. Yeah. Like there's always undercurrents of potential competition or rivalry or who knows what the history is.
Yeah. But... Yeah, so what's the advice then? That's what you're here for, lads.
I can just comment.
Yeah. I don't have to give advice.
I'd get her to question, why does she feel so angry about this? I would actually write out specifically what is upsetting her, what is making her feel so angry, and just kind of free associate it onto paper. Don't really give much thought to it. And you might find at the end of the page, you go, ah, that's what's really annoying me.
Uh-huh.
And I think that point about free association, psychoanalytically, like when we get that rage of anger, that blood, it's because it's touching an old nerve in ourselves. Mm. So whether that's about a brother or a sister or a father, a mother or an uncle, a missed opportunity, there's something in the person's own life that she's furious with these two adult kids.
Okay.
This has just been triggered by the friend.
Right. Good luck with that. Now, dear Alison Ray, I have a bit of a problem. In recent times, my relationship with my partner seems to have deteriorated. He doesn't appear to have any interest in doing anything around the house. I understand he works shifts and can be tired, but when it starts to take a toll on me, when I'm doing everything, I've spoken to him about this and things improve for a while, but gradually start to slip back. I feel like I'm doing all the jobs at home unless I nag or keep asking, which I don't think I should have to do since it's his home too. I feel immense pressure to make sure all the bills are paid, provide for our children. The money he gives me barely covers the food bills. There has been issues with others involved, and this has also taken a toll on me. I don't know what to do. I feel like I've turned into a bitter old woman well before my time, and I've constant headaches. Rarely get a proper night's sleep with the stress and anxiety I'm feeling. Do I stick it out and hope things get better with time? I don't know what to do. Please help.
There's a lot here.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah.
There really is a lot here. And, you know, but in a way, it's very much symptomatic of what we would see a lot. You know, and the presenting issue is they're not helping out in the house at all. Mm-hmm. But the big question here, and what I'm hearing, is a lot of resentment that's built up over a long time. And it's, yes, I know that the housework is a genuine, real problem here. But the line I see is...
There has been issues with others involved.
So what I'm feeling is a huge sense of anger. And she doesn't, like when she's saying the relationship has deteriorated, what I hear is a woman who feels completely disconnected, completely unheard. I don't want to say the word abused, but misused. That she feels that she's kind of just been taken advantage of and her feelings are being taken into account. This is something that needs to work through with therapist. There's a lot of issues here. And there's layers under the layers under the layers. And, she doesn't want to feel bitter.
Mm.
But she is feeling angry. So it's
having a physical effect on her.
Yeah, she's awake at night. Yeah. You know, she's
headaches.
Feeling headaches, anxious. Like when your body is sending you all the messages and all the red flags are waving, it's time to actually say, do you know what? I can't just keep doing the same old. We can't keep repeating the same pattern. What next step can she take or can they take together?
Okay.
Again, I think the first thing, it will not get better with time.
No.
It will only get worse. And I suppose what it seems to be for me at the heart of this is that there's a real gender stereotyping. He's the man that does the work and is doing the shift work and is bringing the money. I'm sure he's working hard, but she's the woman. And therefore, there's a huge presumption around, well, that's her duty to raise the kids and run the house. And we need to move beyond that. But a lot of people, when they get married in heterosexual couples, that's like a presumed understanding, rather than actually having a talk, how are we going to do this? I think what Alison's saying, like, this person should definitely talk with someone. If it's a friend, a sister, a cousin, a woman, I suspect, or indeed a professional, someone who just hears her, because she really needs to be listened to. Because this is building up into, as you're recognising, a physiological reaction that could explode.
Do you think he's the type of man who would go to therapy?
You'd never know.
Yeah, you don't know.
Like, people are, I mean, I don't see why not. Do you know what I mean? Like, people really are genuine. Like, it's people are much more rational about this nowadays, that they're like, do you know what? This is, he I would imagine, is also very unhappy at home too. If she feels bad nagging, then he is also being, you know, nagged too. And so it's going to be a very unpleasant experience for everybody. But what I'm hearing here is the mental and emotional and psychological load is just too much.
Yes.
And what I often see as the next step is it goes into anxiety and panic attacks.
Yeah.
Because the body can't put up with this indefinitely.
So she needs to get professional help.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, my new husband and I have been married for 9 months, but we're still living with his mother. We have a deposit saved and a mortgage agreed, but he keeps finding something wrong with every property I find on the internet. I'm very frustrated and I almost feel myself falling further out of love with him by the day. How do I fix this? And they're only 9 months married.
That's quite intense, isn't it?
I
mean,
it is.
God bless the poor mother-in-law, must be.
But there's a lot going on there. That, you know, they're living in probably a cramped space. And that's pressurised, choosing the right house. That's a big pressure. And it looks like she's doing all the work on that. And he's just going, no, no, no.
And I think that's the thing. It's like, we can cope with, you know, not finding the right house or the right property or the right any. But as long as the other person's participating in the search, because there's nothing more isolating and lonely when you're 9 months married, trying to establish a family home and then realise you're doing it all on your own.
Yeah.
So that has to be challenged. Either they're a couple, and she kind of has to say it to him. Either we're a couple, whether or not we find the home, we have to do this together. So you come up, go on whatever, daft.ie or whatever it is. You come up with five homes. I'll go off and do the same. Come on, and let's see what happens.
Yeah. Mm.
And then a partnership is experienced.
Yeah.
I just wonder what's really going on. Really. Like, you know, it can't be that bad at the mother-in-law's. Do you know what I mean? They're like, she's falling out of love every day. Like, that's really intense. I wonder, has he found fault with her before this? You know, does he find fault with things in general? Like, I'm wondering, is there kind of an underlying criticism of her or choices or decisions that she's made? Like you're saying, it's a massive decision to make, you know, move to a house that you hope will be your forever home. And it's much more difficult nowadays. It really, really is much more difficult experience for people.
Could it be that he sees this as the final door towards total commitment?
Possibly. You know, but you would have imagined that happened.
Yeah. I know you would
but
think that.
But ostensibly easier to get out of a marriage after 9 months than it is to get out of a mortgage for 35 years.
That's so unromantic.
I know.
Oh my God.
I'm just wondering.
But you're right.
I wonder, is there anything there? Is that it?
I think one of the things that might be there as well is, like, when people get married, I've no idea how old these people are, but, you know, we kind of think that, you know, you get married and live happily ever after, because that's what every childhood book and Disney movie tells. And you know what? It's tough. Mm. It's easy to get married. It is really hard to stay married. And so there might be that kind of frustration. I thought we were going to be on chapter 5. I thought the nursery was going to be built.
Yes.
I thought, and it's not happening at the speed that perhaps this, and maybe it's being overread.
Yeah, and they're living with other people as
That's
well.
That's very difficult.
You know what I mean?
No, it's incredibly difficult.
It is difficult, particularly when you're married.
Yeah.
And they're newly married.
Newly married,
they're
yes.
newly married. I mean, like, I have great empathy for this person because, like, but I really feel there's more to just the presenting issue than meets the eye.
Okay.
Like, I wonder what's actually really going on here. Does she just feel that her decisions aren't taken seriously? You know, is he the one, like you say, maybe it's a gender thing again, that he's the boss and he makes his final decision. Like,
or maybe his mother's the boss. Ooh. In true Irish mammy fashion. Sorry, mammy.
I don't know, but I think, again, this is one that they really need to sit down and, you know, I feel so sorry for so many people who are stuck in this exact position. Like, how can they have a normal relationship?
47.2% of people in Ireland between the ages of 25 and 29 are still living at home.
It's not natural.
No.
It's not normal, and it's not good for your relationship. Do you know? So, I mean, like, they're literally just married, and they're tiptoeing around, kind of been in kid roles and in adult roles at the same time. It's very difficult.
So maybe you would hope that that's the reason that all of this is happening.
Hopefully.
And that when they finally choose a house, that it might be okay, might be better. Well, what you're saying is good advice.
Yeah, that I think even interim.
You choose five, I'll choose five. And then make it a fun thing.
Yeah.
That they go see houses, you know.
Exactly.
Let's get into the car and...
Because again, like, yeah, it's a bit like dating. You have to go and look at some bad dates to appreciate what's good about the good dates.
It could even be funny.
Yes.
I hope that place was absolutely horrific.
Yes. Okay. I hope that works out. It is a big deal, though, buying a house. Mm. It's, you know... next one. I've been given a promotion and pay rise at work, but my mother wants me to keep quiet about it as my eldest sister won't like it. And that's in inverted commas. My sister is bitter and angry because her life isn't going well. She's single, unemployed and frustrated. But I'm sick of tiptoeing around her. I don't think I should have to constantly hide my success in life when I've worked so hard to get where I am.
It's really hard, isn't it? Like, it really is really hard. But family dynamics are just, you know...
You've written about it.
Yeah, I have. And all I can hear here is, you know, mother, parent, you know, the siblings. But in her own right, you would hope that it would be nice to go home and say, guys, I got a promotion today. And for it to be heard and for the person to get the kudos that they deserve. You know, that's what family's for, to support you, not to say, shh, keep it quiet. And I do appreciate that her sister's going through a very hard time. But hiding her from the other sister's success is not going to actually have any positive impact upon her, except that she might feel pretty bad that it's been hidden from her when she finds out after.
Well, I suppose the mother's heart's in the right place.
Yes.
She's protecting what she sees as the most vulnerable.
Yes.
In the family, isn't she?
But clearly from writing this letter, the writer here is vulnerable too.
Yeah, they are. And that's actually a really good point.
No matter how old we get, you know, we still want our parents' approval. Mm. You know, and when especially, gosh, it's great when we've some good news to share. My advice here is I hope you have some friends and pals or colleagues that went out and celebrated with you. Because this deserves to be celebrated. Congratulations to you on getting the promotion and the pay rise. But sometimes in life, and particularly within families, we don't get the responses and reactions we need or deserve. So bring that desire to some place it will be honoured.
I think I'd also say it back to the mum. And say, Mom, I totally see your heart's in the right place here. I know your intent is really good. But I'm so happy about this. I've worked really, really hard. And I want you to be happy for me as well. You know, and just say, look, I appreciate how difficult it is for my sister. But this is actually about me. And like Ray's saying, a lot of times what I see on the couch is the person who, I'm not saying the difficult child in the family, the person who actually, you know, went along with everything and was the good kid. They often are the ones who end up in therapy because they're just so frustrated that they never got, you know, the reward.
The kudos
that they actually deserve. So like Ray's saying, I'm saying congratulations as well.
Okay, and have that chat with your mum.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Good advice. Okay, Ray and Alison, that's it. Thank you so, so much. And Ray and Alison will return in about 4 weeks' time with
more
advice.
Yes, thank you, Ray.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a million.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Codeline are back in Studio 10. Mark, Steve, Jay and Vinny. Their new single is Wherever You Are. So you're doing what they call promo now. That's why you're sitting in front of me.
That's what it is.
You're doing promo.
I thought we were sitting here because we were friends.
Yeah. Well, I could do worse than have you as friends. I could. You seem like nice lads. Every time we get on very well, every time we chat. So tomorrow is where? Do you know or do you just go where you're told to go?
We're on the Chris Evans breakfast show tomorrow in London. So
what time do you have to get up for that?
We're just discussing this.
We're just at 5 a.m.
All right.
Yeah. Well, like, we're flying to London after this, like, so.
And how do you deal with your voice that early in the morning, Steve? Do you have exercises you do?
I do actually have exercises.
Give us a go with them. Give us a listen. What do you do? What do you do?
Lots of different things, but at that hour in the morning, I usually just roll out of bed and just find myself ready to sing.
Oh, that's it. Okay, you're not going to give us... Yeah. You probably sound raspy, a sort of nice raspy tone to your voice at that hour of the morning.
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes it's in good nick, sometimes it's not. with radio stuff, especially early stuff in the morning, it can be quite tough. But on tour, it's easier because we have loads of time.
To do what you have to do. So this is the first song from the album, which will be out
during the year.
You all eye rolled there. So what does that eye roll mean in words?
We can't say yet when it's going to be out, but there's going to be a couple more singles before the album comes out. But it'll be out this year.
Does a lot of procrastination and indecision kick in at the final stages of an album?
I think 100,000%.
Procrastination is just always in the studio.
Is it right? And I'd imagine you listen to something so much that you can't you can't really believe what you're hearing. You know what I mean? You can't. Your ears are going. They're playing tricks with you.
I think when you're working on the song, it's different. You can listen to it over and over and over again because you're trying to figure out what you're trying to change. But once it's recorded, I think. Well, for me anyway, I love the song until it's released, and then once it's released, I kind of stop listening to it. Everyone has a different relationship.
You still like this song anyway?
I love this.
Okay, well let's hear it. Right. Okay. Wherever you are, and tickets go on sale tomorrow for Wednesday, 27th of May, Thursday, the 28th of May, and Monday, the 1st of June in the Olympia Theatre, Coat of Line. Thank you.
You say you love me, you say you care, and when you're with me, my future's there. We get carried away in emotion, we get lost in each other's eyes, and we forget what we regret as we cast our fears aside. When the world's getting hard, I will go to wherever you are. Running blind in the dark, I will go to wherever you are. Wherever you are, that's where I'll be. Wherever you are, that's where.
That's lovely. That's Coat of Line, the new single, Wherever You Are, and Ellen from our social media team has shot that on video, so that'll be up on social media before 6 o'clock, I'd say, this evening. Codeline, good luck at the gigs, good luck at the new single, and you might come back in when the album's out. Thank you very much. That was great. Mary Wilson's on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.